Hey, everybody. Let's begin with a reading here. Somebody came to the Buddha and insulted him. I, for some reason, really like old teachings like this. They just get right to the point here. Somebody came to the Buddha and insulted him, and the Buddha said to him, "If you come to my home and I prepare a feast in your honor, and then you don't eat the food, then to whom does the food belong?" The man said, "The food would belong to you." The Buddha said, "Similarly, if you offer me an insult and I don't accept it, then it belongs to you." And here's something from Jesus. "Do not resist an evil person." Which we might read and wonder, well, why not? It seems kind of fun, actually. And appropriate. So, yeah, we're in the at the beginning of a series on the great questions. And last week was more of like a poetic musing about just the nature of being human and the importance of carrying questions and the origin of questions and where did they come from and what's the relationship between your own childhood questions, that first the first emergence of sort of wonder and curiosity and also the questions that you're still presently carrying. I wanted to make a connection between childhood and then what I think naturally just arises, a sense of wonder and curiosity about the world and how that gets squished down and suppressed and bound up, and that a world without questions, I think, is less safe and less interesting and small. You know Rilke's famous line, which I like to quote, "I live my life in widening circles that move out across the world." Yeah, I'd like to live like that, to be honest. That's why I keep quoting it. what's the alternative? I live my life in narrowing circles until I go down the drain, you know. That's... And we live in such a complex world, and I think, so it's important to even say out loud, hey, do I value a widening perspective here, an inclusion of more and greater, and what would that require of me? Well, it would require a relationship with questions. And important questions, like Charity was saying, like, what do you do when you feel hopeless? You know, where do you turn? Where are the sources of inspiration? Where do they come from? And how do I say yes to them? And in any case, I think my point right now is, I think asking questions and wrestling with questions is essentially human. And I think it's an essential part of C3. It's part of the reasons why I love this place and am committed to this place, and it's a place where questions are allowed, and we want to continue that. And one of the things that I've been asking you, and I'm going to ask you again, is to send me your questions. kdobson@c3westmichigan.org. Send me an email with the questions that you're carrying, questions from childhood. Last week, as I was just reflecting on what were my questions as a child, I mean, first of all, I should ask a question. If you were here last week, were questions arising that you carried as a child? Yes or no? Yeah? You're like blank. and are they still present? You know, I remember a very early question, which was, why does the moon follow me in the car at night? And then when asked, and the answer be given, it doesn't, I was like, wait a minute. It very obviously does. So that's what I mean. I mean, where do those come from? And that's actually a very deep question about what is the world and what is a perspective? What is a personal, not if I thought that at five, what is my personal perspective? But the question of perspective and of course, a lot of my other early questions were religious in nature. Like, does God really have the whole world in his hands? Like, I would just imagine that. Like, that doesn't make a lot of sense. And, you know, is God really in control? And the darker ones, like, will God really torture my uncles forever because they're not saved? You know? It just bothered me. It bothered me from really young age. And of course, that's a it's an important question, really. What is the nature of reality and who is God and things like that? Of course, I grew up in a pretty religious environment, so it makes sense. So anyway, I've been collecting questions, and I've been collecting your questions, so keep them coming. And today is a question that was inspired by at least three emails. And I'll summarize the emails by saying, how do we deal with hate? And, like, when I think about that question right now, how do we deal with hate? I think, okay, it's always been a question that the great traditions and spiritualities and religions have wrestled with, and philosophies and political systems. And it's like, we still don't have an answer for that. It's like, here we are. Would you agree that there is a lot of hatred in our world right now? And maybe we can even up the ante by saying, not only is there a lot of hatred in our world right now, there's a lot of violence. And hatred and violence seem to be holding hands. And so it's important to ask questions like, how to deal with hate. Here's what I wanted to title the talk, and I chickened out, so I'm going to title it right now. How do we deal with people we hate? You feel the difference? How do we deal with people we hate? Because I'm not from West Michigan, so I'm from Virginia, where maybe some hatred was more permissible. But there's like this Midwest version of I don't hate anyone, which is really a cover for I don't want to look at my own hatred. And then you have a kind of religious frame, which is, especially if you grew up Christian or in a Christian environment, I guess we all grew up in a Christian environment to a certain extent. You know, we don't think about Jesus as being the icon of hate. We think he's the icon of love, and so we shouldn't do that. We shouldn't hate. Jesus didn't hate anybody. So it's a little bit challenging to get at the question of how do we deal with people we hate? And if you don't like that, how do we deal with people we don't like? And now you're all like, okay, a lot of people I don't like. And I really deeply dislike them in a very passionate and intense way, otherwise known as hatred. So, of course, with the great questions, I'm not intending to, you know, reveal the answer for how to deal with hate. We're just probing. We're filling the room, we're filling the space with the question. And we're contemplating and wrestling and turning things over. And so I want to try to start with this question by asking kind of a definition. What do we mean when we say hate? And where does it come from? And that's also kind of complicated. So I'm going to give you some suggestions. But here's something worth thinking about, which is also a series of questions. First of all, is hate a feeling? That's kind of an interesting question. Is hate a feeling? Like an emotion is what I'm saying. Is hatred, like, do you feel it emotionally? Is it in an emotion exactly? Or is it like a somatic response? And that's like a fancy way of saying a bodily sensation of some sort. It's felt in the body. And that, and if it is a somatic experience, like when I feel hatred, I feel, here are examples, a closing of the throat, a tightening of the chest, my blood pressure goes up, then I have thoughts, usually in that order. That's a somatic bodily experience. And there might be an emotion with that, like the emotion might be anger. Or it's hard to say that the emotion would be hatred, but some emotion might be present with such a thing. Or is it an idea? Is hatred an idea? In other words, is it rooted in an ideology? Like, I need a frame or a category. And by using a certain frame or category, an ideology, a position, then I'm able to see the person in a certain way, and therefore hatred arises. You know, I put them over there, those people. Is it like a complex combination of all these things? And if you would say, oh, it's definitely a feeling, well, where do you feel that feeling? That's a somatic question. Where do you feel that feeling? And if you say, oh, I feel that feeling of tightness in my chest, and why do you feel that feeling? Because that person is a fill in the blank. There's the ideology. So maybe it's like a combination of these three things, which makes it complicated. You can't just say don't hate then, especially if it's housed somewhere as an emotion. It's like telling people don't have an emotion. Like, does it doesn't make any sense. Don't have an emotion. Okay, where's the weed? You know, I don't know how you would then go from there. You just have to live in a numb way. So that doesn't make sense. So here are some possibilities. These are my musings about hatred, because I really wanted, instead of looking up 75 things on the internet, I just tried to sit with it. What do I think, what are possible ingredients? That's the way I'm going to put it. What are possible ingredients of hate or hatred? So one of them I'd like to suggest is that it's possible that hatred is related to or rooted in or fed by or influenced by our disgust impulse, which is evolutionary and biological. You have a disgust impulse. How do I know you have one? Because eventually, if I did something that was disgusting to you, or we encountered something disgusting, you would be like, ah, this is disgusting. And I would say, there it is. All right? And you didn't plan it. It's not like, hey, at 3 o'clock, I plan to be disgusted by fill in the blank. It just arises, and it's a bodily reaction. And actually, most of the times when we experience disgust, like, we do something. You know, it's not even a thought. The thoughts come later. And why is that the case? I don't want to get into all the science of disgust, because that's interesting in and of itself. But in part, it exists to keep you safe. That's why you don't eat rotten food. It's because it's biological. It's evolutionary, and it's rooted in the disgust impulse. And where do we learn that? Well, I don't know, 2.5 million years of evolution plus 7 billion years of planetary evolution plus 14.5 billion years of whatever this thing is. So it's very, very old how we got to be who we are and how we respond and react to the world. So I'm just suggesting that perhaps what we call hatred, at least in part, there's an ingredient of disgust. Sometimes you're disgusted by other people. And if you don't believe me, read the science on smell. Smell and attraction and smell and disgust. If you smell someone, and it's not a universal, that smells disgusting to you, you're going to say, this is disgusting. Now, you might not say that human being is disgusting, but you'll respond in a certain way. And also, same goes with attraction, you know. You can't help it. So-and-so smells good, all right? What can you do about it? All right? You didn't plan these things. So I'm just saying it complicates it if you allow this possibility. Here's another possibility for what influences hate. And this is more obvious. Our ideological frames, the things we're taught about who's in and who's out. This is basic group survival strategies, us versus them. And they're very, very, very old. Us versus them is how any of us are here, really. You know, there were several different Homo erectus beings that lived for millions of years. Did you know that? I mean, there was a group of Homo erectus people that were 3.5 feet tall, and they lived for several million years. That's unbelievable. And where are they? We don't know. We don't actually know what happened to them exactly. A lot of theories about this, but one possible theory is an us versus them fight between Homo sapiens and other people groups. So it's pretty old, us versus them. It keeps you safe. How does it keep you safe? Because your group is safe. Am I making sense? I'm not saying, therefore, go out and everybody find a group and circle the wagons and, you know, I was trying to think of that thing they would shout at the Alamo. What did they shout at the Alamo? That doesn't even make sense with what I was going to say, you know.
Apparently, that's not what I thought they said. Remember the Alamo. Why? Now I'm thinking of Jim Gaffigan. He's got a whole thing on the Alamo. He's like, why didn't they just say, hey, you know, have you guys tried Mexican food? You know, maybe we should just let them in. Anyway, that's dark. Okay, I have no idea. I promise you, there's no mention of Alamo anywhere in my notes. Okay. Ideological frames influence our hatred. Here's another dynamic that influences, and this is the oppressed-oppressor dynamic. The oppressed and oppressor dynamic. When you're oppressed, you often end up hating the oppressor. It's also true, and sometimes even more true, that the oppressor hates the oppressed. And that dynamic fuels the energy between them and keeps the group separate. It's a dimension of hate. And if you're taught either usually you're not taught you're the oppressor. You're taught that you're right and the other group doesn't belong in some way. But it fuels the ideology. And it's also quite easy to see. You know, if you're oppressed, you know it, you feel it. If you're the oppressor, you know how the world works and how it should be divided up. And the fact that you have power is proof that you're right, essentially. And I'm just saying this is an influencing dynamic to how hatred is fueled, we could say. Here's another version. I got two more. Here's another version of hatred, and that's just personal betrayal. That really came out. We were talking in our pre-talk thing, and such a strong reality that we've all experienced. When someone betrays you, and I mean deeply, then, you know, there are good reasons for hatred. That's the way we experience it. And either we cut them off or other possible actions. And it's really rooted in hurt and resentment. Hurt and resentment are present here. And then finally, this comes straight from the Buddha, that all hatred is rooted in ignorance. All hatred is rooted in ignorance. Okay, another ingredient here. He's trying to summarize the whole lot here. But primarily, I think what the Buddha is talking about is ideological hatred and the oppressed-oppressor dynamic. I don't think he's talking about the disgust biological impulse. Perhaps he is, but he's saying it's rooted in ignorance. It's a kind of ignorance that's present. And if I didn't say this at the beginning, I think it's worth saying now. I'm finding that hatred in general is becoming permissible in our culture. Rather than something to be shunned or kind of like sidelined, it's like, no, it's allowed. And the right and the left are both guilty of this, we could say. It's definitely not one side is doing all the hating. It's become permissible. And it's become permissible on the grounds of, well, the other party or the other person or the other group is wrong, morally, ethically, ideologically, worldview. Their worldview is wrong, so it justifies the hatred. And the very next step with that is that it justifies a certain kind of violence. That's usually how it goes. So we ought to be very aware that this is on the rise. And I think, again, that's why it's making it into really the first of these talks, which about the great questions. Is that the kind of world you want to live in? Where hatred is now really encouraged to a certain extent. Especially if you're right and the others are wrong. So, so I want to turn to both Jesus and Buddha for, you know, this is more my wheelhouse anyway, the comparative religion stuff. So I want to look at a couple of teachings from them and see what it might stir up for us. And it is interesting that both Buddha and Jesus, their instructions about human nature, their instructions about how to treat the other or the enemy, haven't gone in all that deep. Because here we are in the world that we're in. That doesn't mean that their teachings aren't valuable. Maybe we could say there's like a kind of underground stream here that's present about how to deal with this kind of stuff that's quite old, and I think hopefully interesting. So, all right.
Question number one, part one here. I want to talk about worthiness, because that's a dimension of hatred. Who's in, who's out, who's worthy, who's unworthy. And so Jesus tells a very interesting parable about this. I want to give you a kind of an unorthodox interpretation of it. So the parable goes something like this. Two men go up to the temple to pray. One's a Pharisee and the other is a tax collector. And the Pharisee says, "Thank God I'm not like other people. And I follow the Torah and I do the right things, essentially. And I'm definitely not like this tax collector." And the other tax collector is also praying in the temple, and this is what he prays. "Lord God, have mercy on me. I'm a sinner," and goes away. And Jesus asked the question, who is justified here, or made worthy, or in other words, he's sort of saying, who's God going to listen to? Now, already, you can admit your bias. Maybe you've heard the parable before, but what's the general interpretation? Is the Pharisee going to be justified before God or the tax collector? Raise your hand if you think it's the Pharisee. No one. Okay. And the rest of you, the tax collector, you're off the tax collector. Yeah, he just said, God have mercy on me, and way to go. Now, here's a little clue about Jesus. Almost everything he says in its context made almost everyone mad who listened to him. So whatever our first assumptions are probably not the right ones generally, or probably not the thing that Jesus is digging around in. In fact, he almost always uses these poles, these dichotomies, a kind of dualism. He takes the two extremes and puts them in next to one another to mess with people's assumptions. So the same is happening in this particular parable. And it's a little more complex than how we normally look at it anyway, because Pharisee today is kind of a bad word. If I called you a Pharisee, you'd be like, whatever. But in when Jesus was giving this parable, the people looked up to the Pharisees. I mean, and even the prayer, "Thank God I'm not like other people," that's not such a bad impulse, really. I mean, don't you sometimes feel that? Like, another word for that would be recognizing your privilege. Really? Like, well, it could be worse based on zip code or where I am in the, you know, all that stuff. What's wrong with that natural impulse? Usually, parables are what's the right word for it? Enigmatic or they're elusive. They're elusive. That's the right word. So it reveals people's assumptions oftentimes more than the parable has a single meaning. So if you're very against the Pharisee for saying, "Thank God I'm not like other people," you're probably guilty of saying, "Thank God I'm not like other people." Do you know what I'm saying? Okay, anyway, that's a bit of an aside. So back in the day, people would have heard that parable and thought, well, the Pharisee, pretty good dude, you know, Pharisees were the teachers and teachers of the Torah, and they generally did do the right thing, you know, according to the law and the teachings of the fathers and things like that. And the tax collector, nobody likes the tax collectors. Do you? You know? Or do you write at the bottom of your check when you send it in at the year, "Theft," send it in the mail, you know? Nobody loves the tax collectors. And of course, in antiquity, they were quite corrupt and collaborators with Rome. But that's too simple. That's too simple. And the problem, one of the problems with this interpretation is not only like a couple thousand years of Christian bias against the Pharisees, but there's a problem in Greek in here. And I got this from Amy Jill Levine. She's a scholar, a Jewish scholar, who wrote a bunch of stuff about Jesus. One of them, a book on the parables called The Stories of Jesus. Anyway, this is what she says about the problem in Greek here. So Jesus says, "Who goes away justified?" And in English, it will read this: the latter rather than the former. In other words, the tax collector rather than the Pharisee. That's not what it says in Greek. Of course, that's not what it says in Greek. It uses the word para, which is where we get the word parable. It means to cast alongside or as well as. So what was Jesus saying? Well, who goes away justified? the tax collector as well as the Pharisee. And people are like, what? Now they have something to get upset about. Because that is unfair. Wouldn't you agree? There's a tax collector going around robbing people. He's justified. The Pharisee is also justified. I mean, are you saying they're the same? And Jesus is saying, well, you decide, basically. You decide. Do you see how we don't like that? We don't like actually hearing people are fundamentally the same. And people are fundamentally worthy of grace, everybody. We're like, I'd like to put that on a postcard, but I don't really believe that. It bothers us, and it should bother us, because it's a question of worthiness. It's also a question of who is worth hating. Guess who was hated in antiquity? The tax collector. So it does challenge that notion, but by putting them side by side and saying both are worthy of a kind of grace, then that's problematic. So Amy Jill Levine says that this is the problem of the middle school group project. All right. Here's how the middle school group project goes. There are four people in the group, three people do the work, and one person doesn't. Isn't that a universal truth? Sometimes it's one person does the work and three people do nothing. And guess what the grade is? The whole group gets the same grade. And this is unfair, wouldn't you agree? We should hate the person who doesn't do any work because they're lazy. Now, the point of the parable, I think, the Pharisee and the tax collector, is a bit of an unorthodox interpretation, I realize, but and definitely true of the middle school problem, is here's the way you should hear this, that everybody in this room at some point in their life is the fourth person in the group project. You are the fourth person in the group project at some point, at some moment in your life. You got what you did not deserve. Am I making some sense? And that messes with our questions of worthiness. Who's in, who's out, who's righteous, who's not righteous, who's pure, who's impure, who's in the right group, who's in the wrong group, all that stuff. It messes with it. And I think this is such an important place to begin a conversation about hatred, because if we only play worthiness games, we know where they're going to lead, to scapegoating, blame, fear, disgust, driving out. That's how the enemy gets formed. And so I think Jesus cleverly comes along and says, don't be so quick. You're the fourth person in the junior high project. You have received things that you don't deserve, so to speak. And everybody is worthy of that extension of grace, you could say. Am I making sense so far? All right. Here's the other thing I want to explore, and that has to do with resistance. And that's in the Zen story. I want to read the Zen story again. Somebody came to the Buddha and insulted him. So the Buddha said, rise up, resist, dominate. Let's take revenge. No, someone came to the Buddha and insulted him, and the Buddha said, if you come to my home and I prepare a feast in your honor, and then you don't eat the food, then to whom does the food belong? And the man said, then the food would belong to you. And the Buddha said, similarly, if you offer me an insult and I don't accept it, then it belongs to you. What a lovely and very challenging little parable, little story. And it has to do with the kind of internal self-examination. So on the one hand, the first story, Jesus, is about worthiness games, who's in and who's out. The Buddha, I think, is taking it one step further and saying, what's going on the internal level here when it comes to what comes out of your mouth and how you what you put out there in the world? And also, are a relationship or attachment to being insulted when things come at us that we don't like, when ideas and people and names come at us. Where do they come from? To whom do they belong? What's our relationship with attachment with some of these things? These are, I think, pretty complex ideas. It's a story about what's inside. There's another, maybe you've heard the famous line, if a snake
drinks water, it becomes poison. And if a cow drinks water, it becomes milk. You know? I know you were all just quoting that this morning. What's that saying? That's saying what's inside is what counts here. And that internal makeup, that capacity to insult, that's what he's saying to the man. That came from you. You're the snake. You're carrying the poison. You're insulting me doesn't have anything to do with me. It has something to do with you. And you should look at that, which is a kind of strange mirror, you could say. Or I think Jesus also gets close to this idea with his line, by the measure you use, it will be measured to you. You know, it's the same kind of idea here. So here's a challenging question. How do we deal with people who hold a different worldview than we hold? You know, how do we deal with such a thing? Well, I think the Buddha would say the first thing we have to do is take a look within. And nobody really wants to do that, myself included. Take a look within. Remember the question of worthiness and practice some non-attachment. Which kind of leads me to my third point, which I think is more related to the question of resistance. Now, listen to Jesus' line here. Do not resist an evil person. There's no parable, there's no story, there's no follow-up. Do not resist an evil person. Why not? I mean, do you accept that? Do not resist an evil person. Do you accept that? Nah, I don't. I have a hard time. I have a really hard time accepting that, especially if I just read it at face value. Do not resist an evil person. Because what would happen? We would just be taken over, killed, annihilated, walked all over. I mean, and if you just think about it personally, don't think like on the level of national security or politics for a moment, just on the personal level. Do not resist an evil person. Well, I think in fairness to Jesus, we have to assume he's probably making us mad, like he was in the previous parable, and trying to stir things up. I could see someone wanting to resist Jesus because he said this, you know. Don't resist an evil person. Who are you to tell me what to do? And there's the resistance. So, and of course, maybe it goes without saying that we live in, I think, a culture right now that is very resistance-focused on both sides, really. So what is Jesus talking about? He's talking about the internal temperature might be the right kind of metaphor. The internal temperature by which we do anything at all. Like, if resistance comes in an aggressive way and we meet that in an aggressive way, what changes? What changes? I think that's the thing that he's pointing out. I don't think he's saying you can't resist at all, but he starts dropping clues about the nature of resistance. He says things like, blessed are the peacemakers, or blessed are those who show mercy. Do you feel like, on the one hand, that is a kind of resistance, but it's not like meets like? It's something, it's qualitatively different, the nature of this kind of thing. So if we start asking questions like, how do we deal with hate? The most straightforward thing I can say right now is not with more hate. That's what I think the Buddha and the Jesus are trying to point out. When like meets like, it doesn't go anywhere. It just makes the world worse. And the poison that we think the other has, we then carry. And we inject back into the system. And it's this, you know, self-fulfilling cycle of poison meets poison. By the way, I'm not saying that any of this is easy. I'm saying I'm reading these things. I'm trying to listen to the ancient teachers here, and I don't even like what I'm hearing. But here's something I do think.
Will hatred, blame, finger-pointing, shaming, scapegoating, outing, canceling, virtue signaling, complaining, gossiping, self-righteous posturing work when it comes to decreasing hatred and violence? Probably not. And I have been guilty of almost everything in this list, and by almost, I mean all of it. Hatred, blame, finger-pointing, shaming, scapegoating, outing, canceling, virtue signaling, complaining, gossiping, self-righteous posturing toward the other side. That's mainly. And so I'm assuming something like meets like. By the measure I use, it will be measured against me. And I think Jesus and the Buddha are trying to challenge some of these very notions here. So maybe here's the final thing I'll say here. And it comes from Saint Francis. He says, where there's hatred, so love. How many have heard that phrase before? That's Saint Francis, where there's hatred, so love. And I want to say, how? How? And I think part of the answer to that is to be less focused on the worst case scenarios. Like, how do I show love to the person I already hate? Or the group that I've already decided is wrong? I think in some ways that's too dramatic. Just start sowing love. I think that's more the point. And I know I sound like John Lennon or something, all right? I'm not trying to sound like John Lennon. That's actually very hard. How do you want to live in the world? What do you want to put out there in the world? Do you want to be a snake with poison? Do you want to be a cow with milk? That's more of the internal question here. And I don't know. I don't think. What's the right way of saying it? Well, let me put it this way. Every encounter and situation, in my view, is a new world unto itself. Every encounter and every situation is a new world. It's like the world is created anew. Right now, in this exact moment, we have never ever experienced this exact moment that we're experiencing right now with Kent saying a bunch of things and quoting Jesus and Buddha and you agreeing or disagreeing or despising or hating me or whatever. It's never happened. Nothing like this has ever happened in the history of all of humanity, of all of evolution. So the kinds of small actions that we take in the moment, what we sow, matters a great deal. And I think one of the dehumanizing realities that we're experiencing right now is that almost every time we hear something, we're prone to categorization and labeling and saying, this is just what I thought it is, or you are just like I thought you were. I pretty much already decided who you were before I ever met you because I saw the sticker on the back of your car, and now I've just been proven right. And I think one of the things that I think Jesus and Buddha are poking around in here is don't divide the world up like that. Every single moment the world is being created again or renewed again, you could say. And what you sow right now really does matter. And I take this question, what do we do with hate, kind of seriously right now. And the first starting place is, what do I do with my own? And what do I want to sow? And what do you want to sow? What do you want to sow the rest of your life? What kind of seeds do you want to put in the ground? What do you want to tend to? And maybe I should leave it at that. So thanks for listening.